Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and I hope you are enjoying, or actually, it's not about entertainment and enjoyment. I hope you're finding the information on our special Game Changer episodes that we're doing on Monday for as long as it takes to go through all of the data. So this way you have a really good, full picture. We need to connect all the dots in the warfare that's being waged. And I say this because until you start getting it, until America starts getting it through its head that we're under attack, that there has been a foe that has declared war against us, and much to our chagrin, we're actually following, we're acquiescing, we're agreeing and following all of these tactics. And most people are saying, well, this is wrong, this is wrong, they shouldn't be able to do this. Folks, they have no authority to do this. And we don't have to acquiesce. We can actually start holding them accountable, and the Constitution gives us all of the power and all of the authority to hold them accountable. This is why the power of the First Amendment petition in petitioning government, because all you need to do is start getting them on the record. And there, I tell you what, any public servant in a red state, in a red county, any Republican, any red candidate, or any red supposedly Republican that is in office, when the people realize that these people are not Republicans, see, we also need to get the Republican Party, the central committees, and at the county level and or at the state level to come out clearly and say, we have people, we have rhinos. And right now, and they need to start educating, because like in Wyoming, the state legislature made laws a long time ago because these guys knew the people that were getting into office were Democrats. The reason that, you know, so when life is going great, nine times out of 10, you know, people don't get involved ideologically in things unless you have an ideology that is critical that you impose upon others. Communism is one of those ideologies, and communism has been embraced and has been integrated into the Democratic Party for decades and decades. So Democrats are doing everything they could to actually seize control. So what they would do, because they knew in Wyoming, the only person that gets elected in Wyoming for years and years was a Republican. So you got Democrats, because when, you know, you had these races that nobody really cared to run, nobody really made a big deal. So Democrats ran, and they were unopposed in some cases, or they were, you know, they had funding and so forth to be able to actually beat out people. And for the most part, they did okay. And they started creating laws that nobody was the wiser of. One of the laws in Wyoming that they created is that the party can't be involved in endorsing a candidate up into the primary. In other words, it's only after the primary where the candidate can actually provide endorsements, because this is how the Democrats shielded themselves from the party being able to get rid of rhinos and Democrats that are actually running as Republicans. They made that the law. So can you understand how they've entrenched themselves, because they've actually made laws that were antithetical to the Constitution and so forth. They actually made laws governing parties. So one of the things, because actually, and we talked about this in different episodes, that the party has the ability to, you know, basically control its own brand, and they have the ability to do this. And the best way to do this is by hard vetting with tests, so that they require everybody that vets with tests, and then they notify. And so the party now has a little bit of effort that they have to spend in educating people. But we're gonna get beyond this in both Wyoming and every state that has these types of things. Folks, we're here to help. We're going to be doing promos so that we can help you understand how we can help you. And so all of these promos of contributing and all of that type of stuff, what we want to do is we want to actually provide you some promos that helps you understand what you really need to be doing. So anyway, today is the Pennsylvania ratification debates. The standard obligatories, as you know, the show is sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you're listening to the only show that gives you the academic evidence and empirical data. We actually read what the framers said. That's why going through the ratification debates is critical. You know, do you trust a person? As a matter of fact, for years and years and years, there was a church that didn't let the people have the scriptures. What they would share with the people would be written down on a piece of paper, and this was the scripture, the sacred word of God, that they would share with them, with the message of what to do and how to do it. And so, you know, for years and years and years, a church actually grew and filled the earth, the Roman Catholic Church. Under the power of the Caesar of Rome, he used his church to fulfill or to fill the empire, which was the world at that point in time, and inflict that church upon everybody. And in that process, the people, as they accepted the church, they accepted, you know, what was being told to them because they didn't have the word to challenge them. And it wasn't until Martin Luther, and this is why this is so important. I want you to understand petitions and First Amendment petitions and the power of them. Martin Luther, having read the scriptures and having been a man of conscience, realized that the church was violating the scriptures. That the church was, the scriptures said one thing and the church was doing something else. So what did he do? He created his 97 theses, he put that on the chapel door, and then he started printing Bibles in German and gave it to the entire German, you know, the Germanic states, all of them. And he started teaching them the truth. And through teaching them the truth, those petitions actually were the catalyst of moving the Protestant faith and actually reforming Christianity on the face of the earth and moving Christianity one step closer to God and God's word. And so as we look at that, it was more of the beginning of a migration to become truer and truer followers or true saints of God instead of letting the church dictate those things. And so that was huge, but he used petitions. That was back in the 1500s. And guess what? In 1215, the right of petition was established in England. So going all the way back to the 1215, this is where this, in yesterday's episode, I was telling you historically, those Neanderthals in the UK that were seemed like, you know, nobody could control them. Their desire for liberty was really what started the awakening and the Enlightenment period. This full desire of controlling government instead of allowing government to control you and moving forward with putting power in the hands of the people to where it was actualized in our Republican form of government with our Constitution, basically integrating the principles of liberty and the Declaration of Independence into this form of government. So when they started helping people understand what this Constitution said so that the states would ratify it, those stipulations, those explanations of what this line really means, what this really does, clarified and basically in legal terms under contract law, these stipulations are legally binding terms and definitions, which are appendages, legal appendages to the compact. So when I tell you that the ratification debates are important, they're not just important. They're legally binding appendages to the Constitution. But not all of them, not all testimony is considered an appendage. Only those testimonies that were clarifying as proponents, those who clarified as opponents, their testimony was rejected, and based on what they were from the proponents, what they said, they accepted the Constitution. When they read it, heard what was being said, and they rejected the Anti-Federalists. There's way too many people out there that keep saying the Anti-Federalists were right, and that's only because they've read the Federalist Papers and they got bought into the argument, the editorial argument in the newspaper, instead of hearing the debates on the floor between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, and how the Anti-Federalists framed and denned the Constitution. In other words, contained it by these stipulations. It was very clear that the Anti-Federalists were basically making assertions that the Constitution, what they were asserting, were actually violations of the Constitution. It wasn't that the federal government could legitimately do these things. They were actually stipulating by the Federalists, or by the proponents of the Constitution, it was being clarified that if they do those things, those would be considered violations of the Constitution. This is what you have to do. And they even started talking during the ratification debates of what to do, because the word interposition was used, and how the states would be able to interpose on the federal government. And we're going to get into all of these things, because we proved to you that we have all the authority over that Constitution as states. These aren't my words. These are the framers' words. And I'm telling you, folks, it's almost like these men are speaking to us from the dust of what this Constitution really means, and how and why we need to definitize it and use it to force the federal government back into compliance. Because the rule of law in a Republican form of government is the rule of the day. The rule of law is king. The law is king. So let me dive into where we left off. So, again, we're kind of coming to the end of the Pennsylvania ratification debates. And oh, by the way, we'll have Paul. I'm planning on having Paul back, hopefully health-wise and everything else. The planets align so we can get him, because he really does add to the show, having the conversation. But his reading, you know, I can read and I can talk and I can articulate, but I'm not the best. And I really love it when other people who read better than me can be on the show to do that. Anyway, this is Mr. Wilson, and we're still on the 7th of December, Pearl Harbor Day, even though Pearl Harbor didn't exist back then. On December 7th, Mr. Wilson starts talking about jurisdiction and common law. And this is what he says. He says, the power, and I need to get these things up. I know I haven't done that just because I've been busy with other things. But before, as soon as we get this all done, I will get these up so that when you read through these, download the Pennsylvania ratification debates, because that's all we focus on. When we do content, it's all focused on this. So when we go through these, you can download these and you can kind of read these for yourself as we go through them and talk about them. And you go, wow, you know, we're not spinning this. We're giving you the dope. We're giving you the truth. This is exactly what they said, and this is spot on. The power of having appellate jurisdiction as to facts, this is Mr. Wilson, has been insisted upon as a proof, quote, that the convention intended to give up the trial by jury in civil cases and to introduce the civil law. Now, civil law is the law of the city, or it is the law of the Roman Empire. The Englishmen and America had common law. It was biblical law. It was law based on fundamental rights of God and so forth. And so, anyway, I have declared, now he responds, I have declared my own opinion at this point, and have shown not merely that it is founded on reason and authority, the express declaration of the Congress, the Journals of Congress, March 6, 1779, is the same purpose. They insist upon this power as requisite to preserve the peace of the Union. Certainly, therefore, it ought to also be possessed by the head of the Confederacy. We are told, as an additional proof, that the trial by jury was intended to be given up, quote, that the appeals are unknown to the common law, that the term is a civil law term, and with it, the civil law is intended to be introduced, close quote. Now, Mr. Wilson goes back and says, I confess, I was a good deal surprised at this observation being made. For Blackstone, in the very volume which the honorable member, Mr. Smiley, had in his hands and reads us several extracts from, as has a chapter entitled, quote, of proceeding in the nature of appeals, close quote. And that in that chapter says that the principal method for redress for erroneous judgments in the King's Court of Record is by writ of error to some superior court of appeal, close quote. And that's right there in the third book of Blackstone, page 406. Now, it is well known that his book is a commentary upon the common law. Here, then, is a strong refutation or refuting of assertion, quote, that appeals are known to the common law. And I go on and say, and he says this, I think that these were all circumstances adduced to show the truth of the assertion that in this Constitution, the trial by jury was intended to be given up by the late convention in framing it. Has the assertion been proved? I say not. And the allegations offered, if they apply at all, apply in contrary direction. I am glad that this objection has been stated because it is the subject upon which the enemies of this Constitution have much insisted. We have now an opportunity of investigating it fully, and the result is that there is no foundation for the charge, but it must proceed from ignorance or something worse. Now, as he proves, and he lays out, and then later on, when the Bill of Rights was added, the trial by jury was preserved. Now, see, you got to remember that the reason why we didn't have a Bill of Rights is because we had an enumerated constitution. But the Constitution didn't declare common law as the law of the land. And that's one of the reasons why people were saying, oh, well, you know, they're injecting civil law. And civil law was not being injected by the Constitution at all. As a matter of fact, the courts were to base everything based on the law of the state. In other words, if the state declared common law and the practice of common law was being applied, then they would have to use their appeals and everything else based on common law. The federal government is, because the federal government uses different laws as well. There is admiralty law. And there is maritime law. And so there is international law or the laws of nations that they have to actually, you know, use and navigate in the international arena. Because the maritime and admiralty laws have everything to do with international courts. Now, here's the problem. Over time, the court system has adapted in our legal process admiralty law as well as maritime law. And as a matter of fact, the courts have created a money-making system out of, or I should say, the lawyers and judges under the Bar Association has created a money-making machine out of our courts. And everything they do is to basically take our sovereignty and give it to the states, or not give it to the states, give it to themselves. See, if you go to court that has no jurisdiction over an issue and you are the sovereigns, like a state, if the states are the sovereigns and they go into a federal court to sue the federal government over something that's not within that constitution, and say, you have no authority to do this. You went to a court. If you wake up and understand what you just did, you went into a court that had no jurisdiction. You surrendered your jurisdiction by going into a federal court. Your court of appeals or your appeal must be to your fellow states. you say, hey, they have no jurisdiction to do this. And you prove this to the other states, and the other states need and must constitutionally create the tribunal. This is what Republic Review is all about. This is why we prove by going through the ratification debates that the states have all the power. And we'll go through all of this as a part of this curriculum, because we'll go through the ratification debates. And then we go through, you know, as the federal government starts moving along, and when they hit their big violation of 1798, this is when Madison and Jefferson pinned the foundation of Republic Review. We'll prove all of this stuff for you. If you think you can break the argument, if you think you have evidence to prove contrary, bring it on. Not even an academic professor even dares to go down that path, because they don't have any citations that will support it. It is all opinion, and it is all hot air, because you know what opinions are, right? Anyway, okay, so the next issue that is being brought up that he's refuting is the militia. And so this is how it all kind of starts off. Okay, so this is, again, Wilson. It's the same day, and he says, it may be frequently necessary to keep up standing armies in time of peace. The present Congress have experienced the necessity, and 700 troops are just as much as a standing army as 70,000. The principle which sustains them is precisely the same. They may go further and raise an army without communicating to the public the purpose for which it is raised. On a particular occasion, they did this. When the commotions existed in Massachusetts, they gave orders for enlisting an additional body of 2,000 men. I believe it is not generally known on what a perilous tenure we held our freedom and independence at that period. The names of internal insurrection were ready to burst out in every quarter. They were formed by the correspondence of state officers, to whom an allusion was made on a former day. And so when he says allusion, it's not illusion, it's allusion. And basically the reference or the mention or suggestion of the insurrection. And from one end to the other of the continent, we walked on ashes, concealing fire beneath our feet. And ought Congress be deprived of power to prepare for the defense and safety of our country? Ought they be restricted from arming until they divulge the motive which induced them to arm? Now, this is interesting. I'm going to let this kind of go through, but you have to understand the process of standing up an army. Anyway, I believe the power of raising and keeping up an army in time of peace is essential to every government. No government can secure its citizens against dangers internal and external without possessing it and sometimes carrying it into execution. I confess it is a power in the exercise of all wise and moderate governments will be as prudent and forbearing as possible. When we consider the situation of the United States, we must be satisfied that it will be necessary to keep up some troops for our protection of the western frontiers and to secure our interest in the internal navigation of that country. It will not be necessary, but it will be economical on the great scale. Our enemies, finding us invulnerable, will not attack us, and we shall thus prevent the occasion for larger standing armies. I am now led to consider another charge that is brought against this system. Now, let me kind of stop. Actually, let me go on and then I'll editorialize, because this is where they start talking. You know, or basically he alludes to the fact that in the West, as we started expanding, the cavalry was extended. And technically, what Congress started doing was Congress stopped using the militia the way they were supposed to. This is where Congress and the federal government really broke away and actually did create a standing army in violation of the Constitution, but it was much later. We'll be right back.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so one advantage of having that, you know, mind operating a little bit faster than the lips is I can actually, I'm out of time and get, we'll be right back. Literally, I've noticed I pulled it out way too often and lucked out. So I need to kind of stop, you know, and let the brakes go, because I get busted that way. Sometimes my hard brakes actually overcome me. But anywho, let me get back to what we're talking about. We're talking about the militia. And at this point, he was already proving that there was a necessity of maintaining some form of standing army in accordance with the Constitution. He didn't realize that the Congress was going to step outside the Constitution, and everybody let him, because they convinced everybody that, oh, well, we could do this. Why? Because they didn't maintain the understanding of the militia and the context of the militia in our republic. So anyway, he goes on and says, this is Mr. Wilson, and he says, it is said that Congress should not possess the power of calling out the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, nor the president have the command of them when called out for such purpose. So in other words, he's saying that it is said that they should not. These are the arguments against the Constitution, because that's exactly what the Constitution calls for, that they should be able to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and so forth. And he says, I believe any gentleman who possesses military experience will inform you that men without uniformity of arms, accoutrements, so it's accoutrements. I usually don't use these words. It's accessories, apparatuses, trimmings, you know, bits and pieces. Anyway, and discipline are no more than a mob in a camp, that in the field, instead of assisting, they interfere with one another. If a soldier drops his musket and his companion unfurnished with one takes it up, it is of no service because his cartridges do not fit it. By means of this system, a uniformity of arms and discipline will prevail throughout the United States. I really expected that for this part of the system, at least, the framers of it would have received plaudits instead of, you know, basically accolades, or, you know, been, you know, cheered and thanked for including these things, instead of censures, instead of reprimands, as they here discover a strong anxiety to have this body put upon an effective footing, and thereby in a great measure to supersede the necessity of raising and keeping up standing armies. In other words, they created a system that wouldn't allow standing armies to exist. And so he goes on and says, the militia formed under this system and trained by the several states will be such a bulwark of eternal strength as to prevent the attacks of foreign enemies. I have been told that upon the year 1744, an attack was intended by France upon Massachusetts Bay, but was given up on reading the militia law of the province. If a single state could deter an enemy from such attempts, what influence will the proposed arrangement have upon the different powers of Europe? In every point of view, this regulation is calculated and produces good effects. How powerful and respectable must the body of militia appear under general and uniform regulations? How disjointed, weak, and inefficient are they at present? I appeal to military experience for the truth of my observations. And then he goes into a different issue. And so then we go into Mr. McKean. And so Mr. McKean now makes some arguments on the same day regarding the actual argument. So this is where Mr. McKean kind of really shows up. And what he does is he basically, he creates this list of the arguments against the Constitution that the anti-federalists had brought to the table. And so what he's going to do is he's going to list out what these arguments are. And then with each of these arguments, he will refute them. And he basically is going to just repeat some of the stuff that Mr. Wilson said. And I think this is really important because, see, again, this is the first vigorously debated debate that we're covering because we covered the rubber stampers. Remember, out of the 13 states, 7 pretty much just rubber stamped and provided suggested recommended amendments. They already went on board. Massachusetts, being one of the smaller states, was the first to actually hard code into the ratification recommended amendments. Every state that followed Massachusetts, and we're going to be covering Massachusetts next, every state that followed Massachusetts that ratified didn't even vigorously debate it, but they did provide recommended amendments. Now, interestingly enough, Wilson and the Pennsylvania debates actually provided some recommendations as well. And so, because they actually proposed some amendments, and I honestly think that Massachusetts got credit for being the first state to integrate it, but actually Pennsylvania did it. And Pennsylvania was the very first state that vigorously debated it. I think Massachusetts, because they followed in suit, made it a more common thing. Now, Pennsylvania was a pretty big state. And again, there's a lot of things that you could get into the minutiae, some really just fascinating stuff. It was the only state that printed the Constitution in different languages. And German was the prevailing language for lots of people in Pennsylvania. So they actually had the Constitution printed in German so that people could debate it. So anyway, let me get into the arguments against the Constitution by Mr. McKean. He says, the arguments against the Constitution are, I think, chiefly these. And then he starts. First, that the elections of representatives and senators are not frequent enough to ensure, and it's with an I instead of an E, because I think back in those days, you know, it was just proper English. But anyway, responsibility to their constituents, In other words, see, one of the things that they were alluding to was that our representation in a Republican form of government has to be driven by their constituents. But that's only because I don't think these men understood, because I didn't see anything regarding the oath. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to break away real quick because I want to look it up and see how many times the oath was brought up. The oath, the word oath was only brought up once. And I repeat myself, it was only brought up once. And that was after McKean started going through the arguments. Okay, so the bottom line is that when you understand, because they're making this argument that, you know, representatives have to do exactly what the constituents or, you know, the majority of their constituents, in other words, they have to follow the mob. Our representatives in America, their first and foremost responsibility is to not follow the mob or their constituents. Their first responsibility is they must follow the Constitution. They must support the Constitution, its concept, its limited powers, everything else. So when the mob comes along and says, we want health care, They cannot listen to the mob. As a matter of fact, they need to communicate to the mob that our government does not allow us to inject. If you want us to do that, then we need an amendment to the Constitution. That's what they're supposed to do. But instead, they started implementing democracy. And over the years, this is how we've been converted into a democracy, because they just started using a democratic form. Oh, well, we're doing what the people wanted. That's because you and America, maybe not you specifically, but the majority of America was no longer being taught that these guys had a legal obligation to support the Constitution. And they weren't taught that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment could remove them if they failed to fulfill that oath. And many states have it in their state constitution that when representatives or any public servant violates their oath of office, they can be removed. So, just to be clear here, you know, when we really look at, you know, who our representative, I'm just trying to clarify. I really went down a rat hole on this, but who has the responsibility or what they're supposed to do? There is not to follow their constituents. They're not in office to serve you. They're in office to serve that Constitution and do its bidding to make sure it is protected. And in so doing, they are serving you and protecting your liberties. How much of a godsend of a government is that? Because in so doing, we have the ability to maintain our liberties and our freedom. When we allow ourselves to chase the whims and the desires of the day, oh, well, we need to eat, government give us food, then we've created a government that can destroy us. Because when you give a government to give you everything, this is Benjamin Franklin saying this, a government that can give you everything can take everything from you. And I'm paraphrasing, of course. But anyway, so second, that one representative for 30,000 persons is too few. In other words, they wanted more people being represented, that they wanted to have, you know, 15, 10,000. They wanted to have a lot. Go look at New Hampshire and how New Hampshire has representation. New Hampshire has hundreds, I think it's like 400, more than 400 in their state house. And they're one of the smallest states, but they have the best representation in the state house. Why? Because they understand what a representative government should do. Unfortunately, they're just equally susceptible and have equally acquiesced to a democratic form of government. And New Hampshire has become, you know, a cesspool of progressivism. But I digress. Third, that the Senate have a share of the appointment of certain officers and are to be the judges on the impeachment of such officers. This is blending the executive with the legislature and judicial department and is likely to screen the offenders impeached because of the concurrence of a majority of the Senate in their appointments. Fourth, that the Congress may, by law, deprive the electors of a fair choice of their representatives by fixing improper times, places, and modes of election. Fifth, that the powers of Congress are too large, particularly in laying internal taxes and excises, because they may lay excessive taxes and leave nothing for the support of the state governments. In raising and supporting armies, that the appropriation of money for that use should not be for so long a term as 2 years. In calling forth the militia on necessary occasions, because they may call them from one end of the continent to the other and wantonly harass them. Besides, they may coerce men to act in the militia whose consciences are against bearing arms in any case. And in making all laws which shall be necessary and proper, he stopped listing these because these are continuing arguments. And in making all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all of the powers vested by this Constitution, in the government of the United States or in any department or office thereof, and declaring that this Constitution and the laws of the United States shall be made in pursuance thereof, and are treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. The migration, so you can tell, so this is a laundry list for the fifth, because then he does go to a sixth. And he says, the migration or importation of such persons as any of these states shall admit shall not be prohibited prior to 1808, nor a tax or duty imposed on such importation exceeding $10 for each person. And then he goes into, now the sixth argument. So in other words, there were like five sub-arguments for the fifth. And then he says, six, that the whole of the executive power is not lodged in the president alone, so that there might be one responsible person. In other words, kind of leaning more towards a monarchy, a king. That he has the sole power of pardoning offenses. So that he has this power, now they're going to complain about the sole power of, you know, pardoning offenses against the United States, and may therefore pardon traitors for treason committed in consequence of his own ambitious and wicked projects or those of the Senate. That the vice president is a useless officer, and being an executive officer is to be president of the Senate, and in case of a division is to have the casting voice. Seventh, these are all arguments against the Constitution. Seventh, the judicial power shall be vested in one Supreme Court. An objection is made that the compensation for the services of judges shall not be diminished during their continuance in office, and this is contrasted with the compensation to the president, which is to be either increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected, but that the judges may be increased and the judges may hold their offices for a lucrative nature and their judgments be thereby warped. That in all cases enumerated, except where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, quote, they shall have appeal of jurisdiction both as to law and fact. Well, that's only to those things pertaining or arising under the Constitution. Just adding that little bit there, right there. Getting back to Mr. McCain, he says, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make, quote, from hence it is interfered that the trial by jury is not secured. Then the next one, that they have jurisdiction between citizens of different states. Eighth, that there is no bill or declaration of rights in this Constitution. Ninth, that this is a consolidation of the several states and not a confederation. Tenth, it is an aristocracy and was intended to be so by the framers of it. First, and now he's going to start going and, you know, attacking each of these assertions or these arguments. And he says, the first objection that I heard against this Constitution, I say, sir, was that, quote, the elections of the representatives and senators are not frequent enough to ensure the responsibility to their constituents, close quote. This is a subject that most men differ about. But there are more considerations than that mere responsibility. By this system, the House of Representatives is composed of persons chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the senators every 6 years by the legislatures. Whether the one or the other of those periods is too long a duration is a question to which various answers will be given. Some persons are of the opinion that 3 years in one case and 7 in another would be more eligible term than that adopted in this Constitution. In Great Britain, we find that the House of Commons elected for 7 years. That's the basic representatives. They're saying it's too long, or it's too short here. The House of Lords is perpetual, and the king never dies, right? So it's a 7-year election for the House of Commons, and once you make it to the House of Lords, that is a lifetime service, and that is an aristocracy. Now, here he says, the House of Lords is perpetual and the king never dies. The Parliament of Ireland is octennial. In various parts of the British dominions, the House of Representatives sit during the royal pleasure and have been continued 20 years. This, sir, is a term undoubtedly too long in a single state. I think annual elections most proper, but then there ought to be more branches in the legislature than one. An annual legislature possessed of supreme power may be properly termed an annual despotism, and like an individual, they are subject to caprice and to act as party spirit or spleen dictates. Hence, that instability to the laws, which is the bane of a republican government. And now he gets into some enumerations. He says, the framers of this constitution wisely divided the legislative department between the two houses subject to the qualified negative of the President of the United States. Though this government embraces only enumerated powers in a single state, annual elections may be proper, the more so when the legislative powers extend to all cases. But in such an extent of country, in other words, land, as the United States, and when the powers are circumscribed, there is not that necessity, nor are the objects of the general government of that nature as to be acquired immediately by every capacity. To combine the various interests of 13 different states requires more extensive knowledge than is necessary for the legislature of any one of them. 2 years are therefore little enough for the members of the House of Representatives to make themselves fully acquainted with the views and habits and interests of the United States, with subject to the Senate. When we consider the trust reposed in them, we cannot hesitate to pronounce that the period assigned to them is short enough. They possess in common with the House of Representatives legislative power with its concurrence. They also have power to declare war. They have joined with the president in concluding treaties. It therefore behooves them to be conversant with politics of the nations of the world and the dispositions of the sovereigns and their ministries. This requires much reading and attention. And believe me, the longer a man bends his studies to any particular subject, the more likely he is to be the master of it. Experience his practice will assist genius in education. I therefore think the time allowed under this system to both houses will be extremely proper. This objection has been made repeatedly, but it can only have weight with those who were not at the pains of thinking on the subject. When anything, sir, new or great is done, it is very apt to create a firmament among those out of doors, who, as they cannot always enter into the depth and wisdom of counsels, are too apt to censor for what they do not understand. Upon a little reflection and experience, the people often find that to be singular blessing, which at first they deemed a curse. Second, this is the second argument he's bringing up. Second, that one representative for 30,000 persons is too few. There will be, sir, 65 in the House of Representatives and 26 in the Senate. In all, 91, who together with the president are to make laws in the several particular matters entrusted to them, and which are all enumerated and expressed, I think the number sufficient at the present, and in 3 years' time, when a census or actual enumeration must take place, they will be increased, and in less than 25 years, they will probably be more than doubled. With respect to this, different gentlemen in several states differ, and at least the opinion of the majority must govern. Third, that the senators have a share in the appointment of certain officers and are to be the judges on the impeachment of such officers. This is blending the executive with the legislative and the judicial department and is likely to screen the offenders impeached because the concurrence of a majority of the Senate in their appointment. And this is how he addresses the third argument. He says, the president is to nominate to the office with the advice and consent of the Senate, appoint officers so that he is the responsible person. And when such impeachment shall be tried, it is more than probable that not one part of the Senate will concur in the appointment, will be a senator for the seats of a third part, are to be vacated every 2 years, and all in six. So in other words, when they created the Senate, it didn't create a election every 6 years that the Senate was, you know, wholesale, like we see with the House of Representatives. Every 2 years, we could actually have a whole new House of Representatives. There is no protection in the House of Representatives for continuity. But what they did with the Senate was they divided the House into threes. And they basically said that each senator, you know, that would be, you know, all of the senators that would come in out of the 13 states, the 26 senators that they were going to have, they were to divide them into three classes. And so however they filled them out so that it was all evenly done, from that point moving forward, the senator in the first class would go for re-election in 2 years. The senator in the third class would be go for re-election in 4 years. And then both the first and second, every 6 years, they would go for re-election. The third class would actually go for the full 6 years. In so doing, they maintain a two-thirds majority continuity after every election. So in other words, there's no way that the Senate could actually go through a wholesale change or purge like the House of Representatives. So that's what he's trying to explain here, that this long-term continuity must be maintained because of the complexity of what the Senate has to do. As to the senators, and going back to what he says here, this is Mr. McCain. As to the senators having a share in the executive power, so far as to the appointment of certain officers, I do not know where this restraint on the president could be more safely lodged. Some may think a privy counselor might have been chosen in every state, but this could little amend the matter, if any, and it would be a considerable additional experience to people, nor need the Senate to be under any necessity or necessity of sitting constantly. As has been alleged, for there is an express provision made to enable the president to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess, the commissions to expire at the end of the next session. So anyway, what we're going to do is we're going to start with his explanation of the third argument when we come back, because I know it seems fragmented and that may have everything to do with the way I'm reading it. But when Paul's back tomorrow, he will actually clarify some of this stuff, or we'll go through this again just a little bit. But I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.